Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Love is in the air, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge. And since Valentine's Day is just around the corner, tonight the Lobot Lounge is celebrating romance. The very romantic gentleman nerds will be sharing our favorite couples and romances in all of geek culture. We'll share our favorites and our most inspiring romances from across the nerd media landscape and hopefully inspire our listeners to keep love alive. Gathered here in the very romantically lit Lobot Lounge this evening, as always, is Mark Finn.
The love boat soon will be making another run.
Aaron de Arrive.
Ich liebe dich, du liebe ich nicht.
That I assume is Klingon for I love you or something.
No, it's German. Remember, that's a da, da, da.
Oh, wow. I thought it was Klingon.
And I am your... I love you, you love me not.
Oh, nice. Well, that's gloomy. I am Joseph Fortinos, your host and emotional touchstone. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge Valentine's Day special.
Yay, Valentine's Day.
Love it. Either you hate it, folks, or you love it.
Well, we're all married, so we get a pass.
It's right. True.
Yeah. The pressure's off. I mean, we still do fun stuff, but it's not quite the same for some of our single listeners out there.
That's true.
So,
and we talked about, you know, maybe sharing things that would inspire maybe some other people to look into or to, I know for me, when I think of romantic couples, you know, my brain goes to a certain set ideal in my brain. And a lot of that is media. A lot of that's what I'm exposed to, you know, comics and television and movies. And I go, oh, that would be great. You know, cause it's always an idealized version. It's always the most perfect little special romance. And even the ones that aren't perfect and special, there's something to aspire to, or there's something to be inspired by. And that's okay. You know, I have no problem with the fanciful representation of romance, because romance is supposed to be fanciful anyway, isn't it, folks?
It's supposed to be.
So I'm going to kick this off because I'm chomping at the bit on this one, only because truly one of the most inspiring couples in my you know, area of expertise, if you will, is Gomez and Morticia Adams.
Oh, great choice. That's perfect. A fantastic choice.
And I would go so far as to specify Carolyn Jones and John Astin from the original Addams Family TV series that played. The chemistry that they had between the two of them, they were very much in love, just oodles and oodles. And it wasn't just the cara mia and the French and all that. It was, this is a guy who would do anything for his wife, who is obsessive about his wife. He worships her. And she is just as much in love with him, but she's always had that cool in control bit. But then again, there are episodes when she didn't, when she was at fault and she messed up. Gomez Adams, for those of you who were living under a rock, and Morticia were the creation of Charles Adams. They were in New Yorker comic or cartoon panel, one panel cartoons that Charles Adams did for the New Yorker magazine. And they were a kind of a macabre a family of misfits. Very human, nothing supernatural about them, but they were just oddballs. And Uncle Fester, Lurch, arguably maybe a Haitian zombie, we're not sure. Grandmama, Wednesday, yeah. their children, Wednesday and Pugsley. And of course, Gomez and Morticia themselves. And this is the part that I really like. of all the TV couples, of all the very early television couples, Gomez and Morticia were the only two that I can think of that very conceivably could have had those children. They absolutely had a sex life and a very active sex life. It was hinted on at the show. It was if the innuendo was put out there. There was always something about the two of them when they, the way they looked at each other, the way they grinned at each other, that they were into some kinky stuff. And I liked that. I liked that excitement. They would pass the time throwing axes in the living room and laying on a bed of nails, one for him, one for her. She would try on a new nightgown and show him, and you know, he would just go gaga over it. And there's just, their life was a party. Every day is a party, as Morticia would always say, with the two of them. And that is an ideal. And they lived in their own world. They lived in that beautiful, dark, romantic little world, and they were family, and it was a gorgeous thing. So Gomez and Morticia, Morticia. And by
the
Adams.
Way, I do want to give a shout out to the fantastic movies, the two movies that were made, you know, with of course Angelica Houston and the wonderful late great Raul Julia.
Yeah,
they, same thing. They brought that absolutely magic chemistry over from the show.
Yeah,
And in some cases, the actual Charles Adams cartoons. The
yes,
the movie opens with carolers singing, and they're singing in front of a house, and we pan up to the top of the roof, and they're about to pour some sort of boiling like pitch or oil onto the carolers, and the whole family's in on it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like they've been waiting for the carolers to come so that they can do this, and that's a very famous Charles Adams cartoon.
Yes,
and so it's there's several moments like that are a wonderful nod, and it is important to note that you know nobody else gets them, you know, nobody gets them. They are their own weirdos, but they're the weirdos that are perfect for each other. If that's not a metaphor.
Yeah,
for our modern swamp of trying to, you know, of the internet and everything else, I don't know what is, you know.
Yeah, there was a fellow student at UNT Film School, and we were all talking about romantic movies one time. I don't know how it came up, and people were talking about how their ideal and the this and that and all the typical ones were mentioned, love story and such, and she kind of looked up and said, "No, if I ever wanted a romance that could not be beat, I would want it to be like the romance of Gomez and Morticia." And everyone just stopped and was like, "Oh yeah, yeah." You know,
well, the show would get letters.
You've transcended. You've gone to another level with that.
The show would get letters from the health community at the time, complimenting them on the healthy relationship that Gomez and Morticia had, despite the things that they would do and the weird things that they would say to each other. What was that Morticia told Gomez? "Oh, Gomez, I've been yours since the first day you carved my initials in your leg."
Yeah. You know?
Right. Which you're taken aback by their bizarre behavior, but they were outside of all the trappings, they were well-adjusted, normal, deeply in love. And they put a little magic in their everyday. Nothing was boring for them. You know, just sitting around smoking a hookah together in the living room, which they did on the show.
It's fantastic. You know, it's
a wonderful relationship.
But ultimately, I think that's they boiled down what love is two people who get each other so well and love what the other brings to the relationship so much that it doesn't matter how kooky or weird or spooky they are. Mm-hmm. That is perfect love. It's that complete union of these two souls who would want to be with no one else. That's love. That's love.
Yeah. Love it.
Yep.
All right. That's my first pass, gentlemen. Let's go with Mr. Mark Finn, if you don't mind. What do you think?
We're going to keep it old school. Yeah. I am unapologetically a fan of classic cinema and also detective fiction.
Oh, and, there you go
there. And so one of my all-time favorite romantic couples are Nick and Nora Charles from the Thin Man series, played by the wonderful – urbane, witty William Powell and the cute as a bug, smart as a whip, Myrna Loy. These are the roles that define them. They played other characters and were active in Hollywood for years. But this was a very successful series of what became a series of movies based on Dashiell Hammett's novel, The Thin Man. Mm-hmm. And while the first movie sticks pretty close to the bone, Dash could not have possibly anticipated getting William Powell in the role of Nick Charles. And it is watching those two bounce off of each other is just a joy. They really liked each other. Yeah. Anyways, and they had immediate on-screen and off-screen chemistry, and they also did a lot of improvs between takes that sometimes made it into the movie. It's just watching them work, and for those of you that don't know, Nick is a retired private investigator, and he has married a socialite. Who is filthy rich and bored to tears. And the movie starts when Nick is contacted about helping out with the case that kind of falls across their lap. And it's Nora that pushes him into wanting to solve the murder. He doesn't want to do it. He's become a gentleman of leisure. All he wants to do is teach other bartenders how to make the perfect martini. and then, you know, serve his own martini to him, you know, that kind of thing.
Nice.
And so along the way, you know, he runs into a host of characters, all these rough types, people that he knows, people that he put in jail, former convicts. And Nora's just fascinated by all of this. She doesn't know what's going on, but thinks it's wonderful, darling, that you're finally doing something with yourself, you know?
Yeah, and so, yeah.
And so, you know, as the series went on, and of course, for those of you who are not yet convinced, they have a dog named Asta that's wonderful. Asta. So Asta's a big part of the thing. Well, as the series go on, she actually gets pregnant and has a child, and the child becomes written into the script, kind of like what happened with the Blondie movies that Arthur Lane and Penny, what's her name, were in. If you haven't seen the Nick and Nora Charles, they're great. Do not make a drinking game out of the movie.
No way.
You won't last 20 minutes. They swill cocktails like it's tap water. If you love the kind of like urban sophistication, sort of in the vein of some of the P.G. Woodhouse stuff, only not poking gentle fun at the upper crust, but rather swimming through the upper crust like sharks. Mm-hmm. That's what these two do. It's marvelous.
Fantastic films.
Yeah, they're one of my all-time favorites. I still will occasionally just pop the first one in and watch it and just to go away for an hour and a half. It's just, they're wonderful. Yeah, and
the wordplay
really good
between them is so witty and quick.
That's back when scripts were written, I mean, just by incredibly talented dialogue writers. Yeah. And it shows. I mean, those old movies were all the dialogue, you know. Yeah. It had an ebb, it had a flow. It's just amazing stuff. If you're a writer, just study these movies and just listen to the dialogue.
It's superb. Fantastic dialogue. And for those of you who are looking for a last minute thing to do for Valentine's Day, you could do much worse than watch the first Thin Man. That's a great film. Even if you put it with a double feature, it ends happy. Mm-hmm. So if you start with Casablanca, you can go to this and not feel, you know, any less romantic about stuff. So, wonderful, wonderful series.
An excellent choice.
Well, I love deeply, Aaron, when I do love.
Nice.
And we know that. We know that. We can feel the love from here.
I'm feeling it.
No, awesome. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, I'm going to have a bit of a theme tonight. Mm-hmm. You know, I started with my little, you know, Ich liebe dich. It's I'm going to pick doomed romances, and there's something about, you know, those kinds of romances that don't quite come together, that just have such a special place for me. That's almost what I think, you know, makes the true romance, you know. And so with that in mind, of course, I'm going to choose Miguel Ferrer's version of Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
As an example of just a beautiful, tragic, doomed romance, but played so well. I first saw the black and white movie with Miguel Ferrer as Cyrano de Bergerac and Mala Powers as Roxanne. And so it had everything that a young boy would want, right? Because it's got the sword play and the costumes and the daring do and all of that stuff. But then, of course, it really is all about this unrequited love on the part of Cyrano. And again, for those listeners who aren't familiar with the story, Cyrano is the best swordsman in France, and his doom is that he has a very distinguishing feature, and that is an incredibly, comically long nose. And so he feels that this makes him a monster. It makes him unattractive. Mm-hmm. And so he has fallen in love with his cousin Roxanne, but dares not speak about his love for her. And so instead courts her through a young, handsome musketeer, soldier named Christian de Neverlette, played by William Prince in the movie that I'm talking about. And so it's just such a wonderful, you know, Christian is good looking and handsome and cuts quite the figure, but he has no gift for words.
Right.
And so has no idea how to romance Roxanne, and just, you know, he's kind of a dolt. So Cyrano, who has the heart of a poet and words to match, decides that he will basically accompany Christian and hide in the bushes and tell him what to say as he stands under the window looking up at Roxanne. Cyrano's feeding him all the lines and basically telling him, this is how I feel about Roxanne. You say it now. It's such a wonderful story, made into a really good film with Martin.
Steve Martin.
Yeah, with Steve Martin.
Called Roxanne. Really good one.
And so, and several versions of it have been made. There's one with Gerard Depardieu as well. But yep, Cyrano de Bergerac. When I think of the ultimate love story, it has to be Cyrano de Bergerac. He dies finally, spoiler, he dies finally confessing his love to Roxanne, and Roxanne is basically just beside herself. Why did he never tell her? Why did he never tell her? So that would be my choice. And by the way, if it comes back around, I have other romances.
Yeah. Oh, good.
We'll come back around.
Somebody has to. I know you guys are going to go for the traditional beautiful ones. Yeah. I had to go for the slightly off kilter one.
Well, I get that. And in the immortal words of Billy Joel, tell her about it, folks. Don't keep that in. You don't want to end up like Cyrano, regretting that you never actually were able to share how you felt. All right. Okay. I'll see your Cyrano de Bergerac, and I'll raise you one of Universal's potboiler series from the 1940s, beginning with The Mummy's Hand in 1939 and going all the way through Mummy's Tomb, Mummy's Ghost, Mummy's Curse. I'm talking, of course, about the tragic love story of Prince Karis, High Priest of the Royal House,
and
Ananka. His beloved Ananka.
Oh, that's good. See, I like it. See, I love these doomed romances. That is where the drama is.
So Universal's follow-up to The Mummy with Boris Karloff is Imhotep, and his love affair with Anksunamun was that story. But Imhotep was subsequently completely destroyed by the goddess Isis at the end of that film. So no more Imhotep. So Universal whipped up another mummy, and they named him Karis. And Karis was a prince of the royal house who fell in love with one of the Vestal virgin handmaidens of the goddess Ananka, who was also a princess. So far, so good. But Ananka, unfortunately, can't. She's sworn to be, you know, married to the god and would live and die a virgin. And of course, Kairos will have none of that. So they loved. It was a secret love. And then Ananka fell ill and died. And of course, when you have the love of your life die, nothing makes sense. Your mind goes. You think, I will do anything to get her back. So Kairos decides to steal the sacred Tana leaves, which are these magical life-giving herb that these mystic Egyptians of the monster universe could boil some Tana leaves and could bring the dead back to life with these mystic leaves. This was, of course, a rewrite of the Scroll of Thoth in the original mummy, but they didn't want to use that. They used the Tana leaves. All right, so Kairos sneaks in, steals the Tana leaves, goes into Ananka's tomb, and does the ritual and is about to bring her back to life when he is busted by the other high priests and those in charge. It is a grave sin against the gods. He is condemned to have his tongue cut out so that his screams won't offend the ears of the gods, what they're about to do to him. And then they mummify him alive. They wrap him and they put him in a sarcophagus and they bury him with a large quantity of Tana leaves in next to his beloved princess, so he could be sort of an eternal night watchman for her for the rest of his unnatural life. Yep. Fast forward to the 40s, and archaeologists dig up Ananka. They piss off the mummy, and a lot of bodies are starting to pile up as the mummy will close these necks, pinch them closed with a one amazing grip of his hand, and they just drop like cut marionettes. And he's very, very efficient. Slow, but very efficient. And that was the thing about the mummy, too. He was very, very slow, obviously. But he could catch you. He was like the tortoise beating the hare. You might go, oh, whatever, the mummy. Yeah, I got plenty of time. 6 years later, you forget about him, and he shows up at your door. And you're like, oh, crap, that's right. I was a mummy after me. Damn. Which I always thought was kind of fun. that was his biggest strength, is that he wouldn't stop. Time was on his side. You know, yeah. You were going to get old and get slow. He was going to continue to do exactly what he does. But the romance part of it is what I want to focus on. And no man... I mean, think about what he went through for her and what he continues to go through. And then you add the reincarnation aspect of these movies in the later series, where Ananka's soul is reincarnated in the body of a young college student. And of course, Kairos recognizes her instantly and ends up chasing her around the woods and carrying her up and down. And there's one particular movie the third in the series, Mummy's Ghost, where he actually gets the girl. He actually gets Ananka in her new body. And together they go into a swamp and she ages in his arms. She turns into a female mummy in his arms, and together they sink into the quicksand together. You know, I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was kind of a sucker punch, because that was our heroine. You know, we thought, oh, the guy's going to rescue her. Surely he's going to rescue her. Oh, wait, what's happening to her? Oh my gosh. What? Oh. And then bloop, it's over. You're like, oh, that's weird.
Nice.
But Kairos is, you know, boy, I tell you, he suffered a lot for her, and he still suffers a lot for her. It's just all about her. And that's talk about dedication, you know, that he does what he does for love. He kills archaeologists and everyone even remotely related to the Banning family. That's what he does. Right. But he does it for Ananka. And there's my second romance is Prince Kairos and Ananka from the Mummy series.
I love it.
Wow.
All right, Mark, come on. Mark? Let's hear yours.
Okay. Well, this is kind of a deep cut for all of you comic book fans out there. And I'm only mentioning it now because the character has finally appeared in the Greg Berlanti verse of the CW shows that have been playing for several years now. And it is the romance of Ralph and Sue Dibny. Ralph Dibny is, of course, the Elongated Man. His wife, Sue, has no superpowers. And they sort of fit a Thin Man mold, actually, to some extent. In the 60s is when he was introduced in the pages of Flash. And his only power was that he could stretch. He wasn't like Plastic Man, although they're doing a little bit of that in the Blaniverse show. He literally could just stretch his arms, his legs, any part of his body was super elastic and would just literally get longer and thinner and stretchier. Well, he quickly develops a reputation as being a crime solver, a kind of a private detective. And in fact, the thing about it that was sort of stupid in the 60s and has now become an endearing character trait is he has a mystery-loving nose. And whenever he senses a mystery, his nose twitches and vibrates, you know, like that, you know. And so so Sue and Ralph get together and get married, and it, you know, the Justice League comes to the wedding, and she is perfect for him because, you know, he's the guy that's always stretching in different directions, and she's the one that always kind of pulls him back. So she's his support, his anchor, and she actually eventually goes to help the Justice League, helping them with monitor duty when they're off, you know, flying around the world, defeating Starro or whatever. And unfortunately,
I hate this part.
Well, DC decided in their infinite wisdom that, that they needed to manufacture some drama. And it's something that actually still is extremely controversial to this day. In fact, I don't even want to dwell on it because there's so many fans who just hate how it happened and what it was.
Yeah,
that it's not even worth mentioning. Honestly, the more important thing is that these were two characters in a happy, stable relationship that does not happen all the time in comics.
Right.
You know, comics tend to be avenues for soap opera-esque or opera-esque forms of tragedy. You know, whether it's the death of Gwen Stacy or Batman not being able to confide anybody except Catwoman, or, you know, whatever the dynamics of the situation are. And so Ralph and Sue Dibny were one of the few couples that were, you know, happy, healthy, well-adjusted, which of course makes what happens all the more galling. Anyways, I'm really hoping that we get to meet Sue in the current season of The Flash, because we've already gotten Ralph, and they've done a great job of him. The character that they, the actor that they've got playing Ralph Dibny, looks very much like how the character was drawn initially, and so they may be trying to kind of make a sort of behind the scenes combine him with Plastic Man. It doesn't really matter though. He's still Ralph Dibny to me. But Ralph and Sue Dibny are one of my favorite comic book romances, just because they really represent that idea that, you know, not every superhero romance has to be this you know, doomed to fail kind of thing. And I think probably it was designed as a counterpoint to Reed and Sue from the Fantastic Four, who were married, but were always, you know, bickering, and that was part of the book's dynamics. Well, Ralph didn't have any of that baggage, and so that's why I loved Ralph and Sue together solving crimes. That was always big fun.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, and that's the you didn't speak about it, which is fine. I'm not going to bring it up either. But you said that Sue had no special powers, and I would say she broke my heart, so that's her power out there. It was hard. But I like it. I like that one. Aaron, you're up, my friend.
All right, another doomed one. A classic story, been adapted many times, but I'm specifically referring to the television version that premiered in 1987. And that is, of course, Beauty and the Beast. What I don't like about the original, the actual fairy tale, is that it actually ends kind of happy. You know, he gets transformed back into a guy. They fall in love, and they presumably go off and live happily ever after. I love the Ron Perlman version, who played, of course, Vincent, the lion-faced Vincent. By the way, it was also my first real sort of, I mean, I'd seen Ron Perlman, I believe it was in Quest for Fire before, but it was him as Vincent that made me first fall in love with Ron Perlman. And not look at his feet, look at his features as something striking and beautiful. You know, he is such a distinctive looking individual. But just the chemistry between him and Linda Hamilton playing Catherine Chandler was just amazing. And by the way, this is kind of the show that I would say kind of launched George R.R. Martin's, you know, sort of Hollywood career. Yeah, he'd been known as a writer before then. He was definitely an author, but he became the lead writer and I think eventually showrunner behind Beauty and the Beast. It was one of his first sort of forays into television, and he did a fantastic job. I mean, I know there's a lot of people make fun of the show. I mean, it's dated. It's definitely dated. If you go back and watch the episodes, you always knew when the end was coming because Vincent would be on a subway. He'd be riding the subway to some location wherever it was that Catherine was in trouble. That's where Vincent was headed. So he always knew, okay, he's on the subway. So we have about 15 minutes left in the show.
Wrap this up. Yeah,
exactly. They did a great mythology for who Vincent was and that whole underworld area that existed with him and father, played by Roy Dotrice, I think Dotrice. Anyway, it was great. And I love that there was no, you know, he didn't turn into a normal regular human and they went off and lived happily ever after in you know, suburbs somewhere. Was this monstrous creature and he was always going to be a monstrous creature.
Yeah.
But despite that, the love is very palpable and you can feel it. And the chemistry was amazing. And again, I like the various different versions that Disney has done and other people have done with the idea of Beauty and the Beast. Hell, King Kong is a version of Beauty and the Beast.
Sure, of course.
And Creature from the Black Lagoon is a version of Beauty and the Beast. So it's a classic tale, but specifically the 1987 TV show. That would be my next choice.
I love it. Yeah. And very much, you know, you mentioned, that archetype of the doom romance and it's always something, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, the Phantom of the Opera, they always have these obsessions that, you know, you can't get quite over the fact that you look like death literally warmed over. So, you know, no, you could have the heart and soul of a poet. In the case of Eric, the Phantom of the Opera, of course, he was completely deranged and psychopathic. I mean, he was a murderous monster, but he did fall in love and he blamed his face. He blamed the circumstance behind his face and how he was born looking like a corpse. Truly he was the monster here, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to comics. Ralph and Sue got me thinking about one of my all-time favorite comic couples, and I've just actually been rereading the Grounded storyline from a few years ago. And of course, I'm talking about Superman, Kal-El, Clark Kent, and Lois Lane.
That's a classic.
And what I really enjoy about them throughout the years, obviously, it reflects the era, you know, that they are being written in. There was a huge, you know, long going, will she, won't she, will she find out, he's hiding it, that classic Superman Lois Lane relationship. They even had a comic title, and of course I know that Mark Finn will chime in with a year or two here, but it was called Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane. She had her own title, and that was the actual title of the comic.
It was the mid to late 60s.
So they kind of relegated her to being Superman's girlfriend, which you know, I get it in that era, sure. But the way that they do her now, because they're married, unless they've restarted, I haven't picked up a comic book in a long time, but the last time I checked in, the Clarks were actually married and were you know, she obviously knew he was Superman. You can't really hide that kind of thing from your wife. But they had this great relationship where, you know, she just knowingly nods and winks and she has to share him with the entire galaxy, essentially. And she knows it. She gets it. But then there's precious moments where they fly through the city together, and she's like, "This is mine. This is the part I love, is being with you like this." You know, and Clark, you know, I think he loved her the minute he set eyes on her. Right? There was something about this strong, hard-nosed reporter that was unlike any woman he had known in Smallville, unlike any woman he had known. Period. Lois Lane comes bursting onto the scene and just steals his heart. He talks about being brave, Superman. He says, you know, Superman's not brave because he's invulnerable. I mean, it's easy to be brave when you're invulnerable. Right. Lois Lane is brave, and she's human. And that's one of the things that I adore about Superman, and I always have. He adores Lois, but he loves humanity. He loves people. He loves the people of this planet. And Lois Lane is one of the best people on this planet. And I think she inspires him. I think she gives him something to work towards, to be that symbol, to be that hope. Because I think that even with all her faults, I think Lois Lane is a good grounding for him, and certainly somebody who, you know, if anything would happen to, would set Superman on a dark path. I think that's been explored in a few comic stories where Lois Lane gets killed in some way, and then Superman
they were trying to explore it in the movies, but the reception was not well. It wasn't good, and so they kind of changed that. But
Superman and Lois Lane, that's a classic all-star couple for me, and I'll always go with that.
I'm a big fan of especially the earlier portions of the story where they're trying to where she's trying to suss out who Superman is. I always found those very rewarding in that regard. And of course, one of my all-time favorite versions of Superman are the Fleischer cartoons. Terror on the Midway has one of the best exchanges of dialogue in it. It was very rare for Clark to get past Lois. You know, Lois was always the dominant personality in the Lois and Clark relationship. There's a wonderful, at the very beginning of Terror on the Midway, they're at the circus, and they snap a picture of a little monkey. He scampers off, and Clark says, "A fine thing, scaring a monkey like that." And she says, "All right." And then he says something like, "Ace reporter scares monkey." And she says, "Ace reporter covers circus. What an assignment." And he goes, "Yeah, Lois, too bad. It sure is a nice night for a murder or a fire or something like that." and then, ladies and gentlemen, and then they, you know, they go over to the big top. Yeah. But I just love the, it's very rare. It was very rare for him to get one by on her, but that was that was a beautiful bit of chin music right over the plate, you know.
It was a cartoon, The Adventures of Superman, I think in the 60s, and they would always end. I always remember, you cracked me up. This is the one that was, you know, Superman, the Man of Steel.
Yeah, the filmation, right? Yeah. The filmation, right.
But then it would always end with kind of Clark messing with her. Like, you know, after the adventure was over, Clark would come in with some, like, for example, there's one episode where this villain traps her in a bubble or something like that. And then so she's pretty shook up about it. And at the end, he comes into the newsroom, and he's got like a bubble gum or something. And he's got, "Hey, Lois, we'd like a bubble gum." She's like, "Oh, Clark, oh." And he winks at us like, "Ha ha ha." He's just messing with it. Every cartoon ends with him doing something like that. You know, when he looks at us and goes, "Ah," you know, gives us a wink.
Gives that wink. Yes. I love when those episodes end with him winking at us.
Oh, Superman, you asshole.
He could be a real jerk. Good stuff.
That's the superhero equivalent of pulling on the girl's hair because you really do like her, I guess.
Right. Yes, I think so.
That's how, on Krypton, we'd remind them of their recent trauma. That's how she knows I'm choosing her as my intended.
That's right. Yep. Oh, Lord. All right. I think you, Mark, I think
Mark, yeah.
you've got one.
Well, Aaron got me thinking about doomed romances.
I would infect you.
Yes. This is one of the all-time greats. Seriously, folks, if you have not seen this movie, and you consider yourself a movie aficionado, this is one of the this is one of the must watch films. There is there's a reason why it's on everybody's top 10 list, and it is a classic in every sense of the word, from soup to nuts. Casablanca, starring Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman as Rick and Ilsa. It is.
I actually wondered if someone was going to mention Casablanca. I should have figured it was going to be you, Mark.
Well, I wasn't gonna, but then we got to talking about doomed romances, right. And of course, you know, I feel weird like saying spoilers because like if you don't know how this movie ends, I mean seriously, like stop listening to this podcast and go get it on Amazon. Go watch on Amazon Prime. I'm serious. There's, you know, I those of you who are under the age of 35, I know the movie's in black and white. I know that you won't be able to actually see blood spatter. It's okay. You're going to get through it just fine. It's an amazing film directed by the great director Michael Curtiz, who was responsible for so many classic Warner Brothers films, everything from Robin Hood, starring Errol Flynn, to King Creole, starring Elvis Presley, and all points in between. He was considered an actor's director, but he was also a contract guy. And the thing about Casablanca is, when they shot it, they weren't intending to make a classic. You know, they weren't shooting for literary greatness. They just, you know. Everybody was on a contract. We have this thing. This ought to be a fun little movie to put up. You know, it was based on an unproduced stage play. You know, this is one of those things where the pieces together are greater than some of their parts.
As proven, by the way, by Barbed Wire, which basically Casablanca, but without all the magic.
And it's just Casablanca. Yeah, it's a gender flipped Casablanca, and it's just one of many times this film, or the tropes from the film have been utilized in popular culture. If we start going down the list of dialogue that's been borrowed, repurposed, appropriated. You're going to go, I mean, this is in some ways, and I really don't mean this lightly. It's Shakespearean in that there's lines of dialogue you've been hearing your whole life that people say that you didn't know came from this movie. This is your homework, ladies and gentlemen. If you've not seen Casablanca, this has to be on your list. There is no better doomed romance in film than Rick and Ilsa, and the sacrifice that they make at the end, and it is so good.
We'll always have Paris.
Victor, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. You know, there's so much, and what's great about it is that it's one of those ones where you cry and smile at the same time. It's genius. Also, for those of you who are 25 and under, hey, guess what? It's about a fight against the Nazis. So, yay. See, topical.
Conrad Veidt as a Nazi.
Nice.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on here.
Yes. You're right. There's so many lines.
There are. It's tremendously well written. It's beautifully shot. It's a gorgeous film from top to bottom. An hour 45. I mean, seriously, like I said, you cannot really consider yourself a student of American cinema if you have not seen this movie. And the fact that it contains one, it's one of the best love stories of all time in the history, certainly in the history of 20th century film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always been considered one of those kind of movies. And so I think the doomed relationship, the way Bogart plays a guy who literally doesn't take a side, and specifically so that he doesn't have to care, because he cared once and look what it cost him, you know. Yeah. Oh, it's such It's such a, this is the other thing too, for being such a romantic movie, it is a guy's movie. Mm-hmm. It's a dude film. I mean, what Rick does and how Rick does it, is one of the components that goes into the better nature of masculinity as we understand it. Yeah. So, Rick and Ilsa, from Casablanca, doomed to failure, endlessly inspirational.
Nice. Fantastic choice. Good. All right. So it's back to me now. Do I take this out on the, okay, here's a go. I'm going to try to outdoom Mark. Here's from something much more recent. And the reason it worked, I think, so well, is because they stretched it out. They really teased it out over the course of 7 films. But there is no more doomed, more tragic, and more heartbreaking love than that between Professor Snape and Lily.
Oh, you bastard, you there, win!
There is no more doomed love than that. And I remember, you know, of course, none of us had any idea when we first started watching those movies where that was going to go. We just knew that Professor Snape was mean to Harry. We had no idea why. Oh, he's just an asshole. Everyone's had a teacher like that. He's a villain, no doubt. And then just what Rowling did with his character, his arc, his backstory. Here is a young boy who was, from the moment he laid eyes on her, in love with this woman. Mm-hmm. And just, that's all he cared about. And of course, Lily loved somebody else. She loved Harry's dad, James. And James was mean to Snape. And he would bully him, and they would make fun of him, and they would, you know, they did all the things that school bullies do. And Snape just sort of sucked it up. He never said a word. He never complained. But of course, he hated what was done to him. And so started to take that out on Harry. He reminded him of his father. And that is a person that just was nothing but painful memories. Mm-hmm. But his love for that woman was so great that he sacrificed his life to save mm-hmm. that boy because she had her eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harry had.
Harry had his mother's eyes.
He looked at Harry and said, "You have your mother's eyes." And that, to me, I was like, oh, holy shit. This beats Romeo and Juliet. This is it. He did everything for love.
Yeah.
Including you can very safely say without Snape, the good guys would not have won.
He's integral to it all.
So I love when that played out, you know, and of course, again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I have a penchant for doomed romances. And I was like, holy cow. I mean, tears are coming down my eyes. I'm going, wow. I want to stand up and start clapping. It's like, bravo. Bravo, yeah. J.K. Yeah. Rowling.
Yeah.
What a beautiful, doomed, tragic love.
Well, and you got to give props to Alan Rickman Rickman actually played that. And that's not something that... I mean, she hit it very well in the books. I would argue she almost hit it too well. But there are a few scenes in the movies early on where it's obvious Snape knows, you know, what or it's obvious that Alan Rickman knows that Snape was in love with his with Lily, and it was an unrequited love. In fact, I will never forget this, and this just it kind of sucks because I suspected the fix was in the trailer for Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix during the occlumency sessions where he's trying to build up Harry's resistance to being having his thoughts read.
Yeah.
And there's a scene where You know, Harry says something like, I'm not weak or I'm not afraid. And they cut to Alan Rickman going, then prove it. The expression on his face is not an angry expression. It's almost a pleading expression. His eyes are wider. His demeanor is very different. You know, he's trying to help him, and you can see it. And when I watched the movie, they used a different take. It's a different take, and he's meaner in the film. And I think it's because they thought it gave too much away.
You know, I remember that. Yeah, I think I remember that.
Yeah, if you go back and if you watch the trailer, you'll know the scene when you see it. But yeah. but that scene is meaner in the film. And in fact,
the story is that Rowling took Alan Rickman aside and told him.
Yes. And he was sworn to secrecy.
This is the right. And so from then on, very early on in the series, he was told, from then on, he knew exactly how he was going to play his character.
If you go back and rewatch those movies, like I have recently done, you can see it in his performance. Not, you know, there are a few times, you know, of course, some of them are just hysterical because of the way he played the character. But there are a couple of times where he's looking at Harry Potter and you think it's menacing because you know it's Snape and you think he's the bad guy or whatever. Right. And actually in one scene, it's actually almost wonder, like he's looking at Harry and going, I can see Lily in him. Right. You know, by the way,
and they bring that back so beautifully, which is the scene that brought me to tears. After he's viciously attacked by Nagina and he's lying there dying and Harry comes to him, the look, if you go back, folks, go back and watch that scene and look at how he looks at Harry.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, Jesus, your heart breaks. Your heart breaks in that scene. You're going, my God.
Well, wow. The flashback where he's holding dead Lily in his arms and howling is just the worst.
Oh yeah,
it's just the worst.
That I had to end it with that, folks. I had to plunge the knife in and twist it.
Well, yeah. Thank you, Debbie Downer.
Well,
no, but it's a great romance. Yeah. I mean, it's one-sided,
It's one-sided, but it's also inspiring. I mean, if we can consider ourselves, you know, half the soulful person that Severus Snape was, for God's sakes, there's hope for everyone. I mean, now, obviously, we wish you all a very happy Valentine's Day and one that you know, you have some, you know, happiness and you find that person. And we all want to be with somebody, sure. But you know what? It doesn't really matter what this teaches us, folks, and this is what I love about romance and Valentine's and just, you know, what we just talked about, the idea that just be nice to one another. It doesn't have to be this grand romance. And just because you don't, you know, you're not married and you don't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend doesn't make you, you know, a failure, for God's sakes. No, not at all. But romance is not just the traditional, as we've heard tonight, but it's also the emotion we carry within ourselves, the ability to be empathetic towards other people and to make human connections. Yep. And that's the important part here. It's not about the grand romance and the chocolates and the flowers, and it's human connection, and we need that in this world right now. Oh my God, do we need that?
Oh yeah, no desperately. And like Joseph sang before, you know, tell her about it or him about it. Don't, life is too short, folks. Life is too short. If you are so afraid of rejection that you will not put yourself out there, you will never ever find your Gomez or Morticia or Lily or Nora. I mean, you have to put yourself out there, and you know, take a chance. You might get rejected and it'll hurt, and you'll need.
Well, on that rather happy note, The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak and Dagger production and written by Aaron D'Orive, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, and Joseph Fotinos. With additional material by Harry Warden, you know, the guy with the mine hand. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot, nameless but loved, created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender was Madame Ruth. You know, that gypsy with the gold cap tooth. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs. Our executive producer, and a man we all pray never gets superpowers, is Aaron DeRive. The gentleman nerd's attorney is Dr. Gonzo. A segment or playlet of the TV show Love American Style in February of 1972 was entitled Love and the Happy Days. And that, my friends, was the original pilot for the TV show Happy Days. Oh, and by the way, Universal's Dracula originally released to theaters February 14th, 1931, and promoted as the strangest love story of all time. Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher DeRive. Please join us with your loved ones or by yourself in the Lobot Lounge when next we open. Please always tip your bartenders and your waitstaff. Final words, gentlemen?
Mark? Real quick, don't be afraid to go after what you want. And we all deserve to be happy in the crazy way that we already are. Find your match. You've got a cog out there that fits you. All of us do.
Love it.
Yep.
Aaron?
May your romance never, ever, ever be anything like Snape's.
That's very, very wise words. I do want to dedicate this episode of the Gentlemen Nerds to our own beautiful wives who listen to the show and support us and all the crazy things that we do. We love you, ladies. Thank you. Yes,
very much.
I'm Joseph Fortinos, reminding you once again that Red Skull lives.
The new 50 Shades of Grey. So we're wondering if you were just watching that on an endless loop.
Oh, no. 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 Well-